CliffCentral.com.
Listen, you can hear the devil in the song. You hear that?
I thought that was Madonna.
No, it was Madonna.
I thought the devil was more a Lady Gaga fan. Like, he makes appearances in Lady Gaga's songs more than Madonna.
There are a bunch of people.
Are they using his? Are they both using his services?
Remember when Lady Gaga came here and there was that group of people who were boycotting and picketing and complaining that the devil was coming?
Yes.
Yeah. Clearly, he switched.
It was a very scary time.
Really, you were scared? Were you scared? Yeah, sure. It was a very scary time, says my buddy.
Time.
No, nothing happened. Nothing happened. What are you up to this morning? 0861-555-189, Monday. If you can make it through Monday, you can make it through the rest of the week. Right? Guess who's back?
Clues, again. Please.
Well, he's got a birthday coming up, and he's told us what we should do for his birthday. I'll give you the first 2 seconds to guess who this is.
Not bad, eh? Anyway, you know why I'm here? I'm here to remind you on the 7th of July.
Do you know who this is?
It's Ringo.
Yeah, it was his birthday on the 7th of July, so he wanted to remind us of something. You want to hear what he wanted?
I'm here to remind you on the 7th of July.
Oh, we've missed it already.
At noon, to make me happy.
How?
Wherever you are in the world, just to go. Peace and love, peace and love. I'll be doing it in L.A., but you could do it in Russia. You could do it in Japan.
Yeah.
You could do it in New York. Anywhere is good. Peace and love, peace and love. At noon on the 7th of July, 2016, of course.
All right. Thank you, Ringo. We're sorry we missed it. Ringo Starr. I mean, this guy's so full of instructions. Do you remember this one?
Peace and love, peace and love. I want to tell you, please, after the 20th of October, do
always
not
a date.
Send...
There's always a date.
He's very specific.
He's like a countdown monger.
So do not send, you remember this.
Fan mail to any address that you have. Nothing will be signed after the 20th of October. If that has a date on the envelope, it's going to be tossed. Oh, yeah. I'm warning you with peace and love, but I have too much to do. So no more fan mail. Thank you, thank you. And no objects to be signed. Nothing. Anyway, peace and love, peace and love. I'm here to remind you on the 7th of July.
Yeah, now he's telling us the 7th of July. You know what, Ringo? Stop it.
Has it ever been determined what his too much to do actually is?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, clearly it's just
what
saying,
has he got to do?
Saying peace and love, as much as he can. That's what Ringo's doing.
And really, how much fan mail was he receiving?
Oh,
he
please.
Makes it sound like he was being snowed under.
You're not Paul McCartney, dude. I mean, relax.
I mean, I for one stopped sending him my pictures. We just never signed them.
Shame.
I don't think Ringo has anything to do.
Was
he playing at shows? I don't think so. Who needs Ringo? You could get 1,000 drummers who are better than him. Even the Beatles said that they weren't so sure he was meant to be a part of them.
When did they say this?
Well, if you read Paul and John's notes to each other.
Oh, okay.
Nobody really. Why Ringo had to last and George and John had to go, I do not know.
Was Ringo the Michelle of the group?
Worse, because he was the fourth. Michelle was only the third of Destiny's Child, right? So if Beyonce died, Destiny's Child would have been finished. Carpet pulled out under them. If Kelly had died, they would have been badly affected. But if something happened to Michelle, they'd carry on.
Well, they would get just right. Someone else.
So in the Beatles, if something happened to John or Paul, depending on which side you're on, because there are a lot of people who are very much Paul people, very much people who are John people. Oh. Either way, if John or Paul, something happened to them...
Yeah.
Boom, end of the Beatles. Because they wrote most of the songs. If they lost George, they would have lost a lot of their value. Like, George was a great guitarist. George was a visionary. He wrote songs like, Here Comes the Sun, do-do-do-do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right. And that beautiful guitar that goes, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. That was George.
What did Ringo do?
Fuck all.
Was he like cymbals or?
Fuck all. Did nothing.
He played.
If someone drove over Ringo while they were doing a show, that the other three could have carried it. In fact, I'll bet you that one of the roadies could have beatboxed their way through the percussion in the Beatles. It's not complicated percussion. You've heard their songs. Let me give you a clue. Let me give you a song that... I'll find a song that... Let me show you this. To illustrate the point. Here they are. Listen to the drums, all right? This is an original recording, so you know it's Ringo. I can play that on the desk. Do you hear that? Listen to me. Listen. I'm doing a better job than Ringo with my hands. You hear that? And you don't hear him singing, do you?
Now let me hold your hand. You let me hold
There's no
your
Ringo
hand.
In the song. There is no Ringo here. And when he leaves the band, nobody will miss him. He could go walking while we're on stage. You won't mind, you won't mind, you won't mind. Get out of there, Ringo. Peace and love, peace and love.
Peace and love.
Why Ringo had to go. We could still have George among us. We could still have John. Well, Yoko killed John, I mean, you know, everybody knows that. You remember the story, Mubs. Oh. Don't pretend you don't know.
Sure, sure.
Ah, oh, John! John, why don't you go for a walk on New York Street? Very safe. Yes, only the 70s. 80s. 1980. Very safe on New York Street. No drug addict around. No dangerous people outside the Dakota building. Yes, go for a walk.
But, oh, Yoko, I don't know. It's sort of dangerous. People know me here.
Don't worry, John. You go for a walk. I inherit Beatles money. I live in this Dakota building for a long time. I make my own songs no one want to buy. But doesn't matter, because I got your money.
What? Did you say Yoko?
No, nothing, John. Go for a happy walk on street. One of my friends, Mark David Chapman, outside building to guide you around.
Oh, okay. What's his name again?
Mark David Chapman.
All right, I'll be sure to say hello to him. Bye. See you later, darling.
Yes, when you come back, we have bed in.
You remember they used to have those things called a bed in?
Did they just stay in bed the whole day?
Stayed in bed for like a week.
Oof.
Just the two of them
in
bed.
Did they shower?
They'd do all their interviews in bed. They'd do television crossings in bed. They didn't clean themselves. Mm. They'd have sex. They wouldn't wash for like 7 days. Can you imagine?
Mm.
Ugh, and Yoko had that long hair, and John had that long hair and those stupid glasses. I mean, it must have been horrible. I heard they had to fumigate the Dakota building afterwards, the whole building. That's probably why Mark David Chapman was there, for the smell. You know, he was a lunatic. He came just for the smell. All right, enough nonsense. We've got to get to David Higgs. This is a really, really interesting dude. I can't tell you how much. Ben was telling me just now, he was actually the... he was the chef for our cycling team, right?
Well, MTN Quebec when they're in the Tour de France.
Right.
So
you've got to be very careful what you put into that.
We were talking about calories earlier, putting in, putting out. These guys are like racehorses times 1,000, right? So
absolutely.
they need like endless calories. They're a bottomless pit of calories, these people, because they're expending so much. Well, and he had to source all the stuff and make it happen.
I'm very excited to meet him. It's you know, I don't know the first thing about celebrity chefs. I don't know the first thing about food, because I'm useless in the kitchen. So when I can't win at something, as Ben knows all too well, I don't even take part.
So you don't do much?
No. I'm not a great sportsman. By the way, thanks for that comment. It's very kind of you. I like to do things I can win. Hey, David, nice to see you, man.
Nice to
Let's
be
welcome
you
properly. Give you a fan there. It's a pleasure to meet you. I mean, I looked at this list of things that you've done in your life, and this is some CV, man. Huh?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, firstly.
Sure. What a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a great journey for me. Done some incredible things. seen some incredible things, traveled a bit, and yeah, I always based myself in South Africa. I think that's I think for me is key. You know, I've been overseas, I think 2-3 weeks at most at a time.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I've never ever really wanted to leave South Africa. You know?
Now, what was the kind of the point at which people started to take notice? Was it when you were the head chef at the Saxon?
No, look, I think a couple of things happened. I was actually on radio for about 4 years down in Cape Town, and I had a little, I literally had a minute a day, what they call the gourmet minute.
Oh,
and
wow.
I mean, you know what radio...
That's tough. They expect you to make an impact for 1 minute, right?
Let me just tell you.
What station was this?
It was with KFM.
KFM. They wanted you to talk about something for a minute.
Literally, I had to come out, and for 4 years. I mean, you can imagine how difficult it is. You know,
I mean, how many things can you do in a minute? It's incredible, and you managed to do that every day.
Yeah, every day. Well, anyway, it was pre-recorded as it goes. But
wow.
But yeah, I think that really sort of put me on the map and really helped my career.
Wow. Okay.
But I think the big thing for me was I started a restaurant called Rust and Fierda down in the Cape on the Winelands.
Oh, okay. Who hasn't heard of that?
And you know, that was huge, and that was almost a culmination of everything that I'd sort of done over the last sort of 15 years. You know, I did everything from outside catering to industrial catering. I mean, literally, we had a company, myself and my business partner, had a company that made all the Spur desserts, for instance.
Wow.
Like, literally every single Malva pudding that was served at Spur, we made.
But that's good
made.
Business, right? I mean,
incredible
in terms
business.
Of numbers.
No,
you
I
know,
mean, it's daft.
That's incredible.
The margins are small, but it was really good. And anyway, I had a chef school, and I worked in restaurants and done various things. But the rest in Fierda was sort of, as I said, a bit of a culmination of everything.
Now, David,
I'm hearing very good things, but Chico the Clowns were there in there as well.
Shut it.
I remember those Chico the Clown ice cream.
We had a big problem with that. They kept melting. You know?
Yeah, you produce them 3 days in advance. It doesn't work so well. But David, it's really hard to be in the chef game for a start, but to be a celebrity chef, and I use the inverted commas because a lot of people are consumed with the fact that they're going to be famous for their food, for their cooking, for their kind of offering. And it's very difficult to break through the noise because there are so many people competing in this environment internationally and locally.
Yeah.
So to get ahead in food is tough as nails.
Yeah. And this is exactly what you said there. You know, celebrity chef, I'm not always fond of that title. You know, I'm a chef. I've worked bloody hard to get where I have, and
sure.
And the whole celebrity thing is, you know, sometimes takes sort of the wrong connotation. It takes the
well,
wrong
it's a poison chalice because people have huge expectations then, and you have to keep on outdoing yourself, which just becomes exhausting.
Yeah, but I think that's exactly it. You keep on outdoing it, and you just keep pushing yourself to that next sort of level. And what is out there, and what is? But you know, I've got to a stage now where I just really want to enjoy myself, you know, and I'm very fortunate to be in that position. I've got a great business partner. We're doing something really special in Rosebank. And
who's that? And give them some credit.
Gary Kiriakou is a guy who walked into my office about a year ago and said to me at the Saxon, I was sitting there, and he walked in my office and said, listen, I've got a plan. And I said, yeah, sure, you know, shoot. And he showed me this presentation of what he wanted to do. And that's what we're busy with at Marble in Rosebank.
It's called Marble.
It's called Marble, yeah.
Very, very nice. Sounds terrific.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff are you going to make there?
Essentially, the basis of Marble is everything is cooked on fire, proper wood fires. And, you know, if you look at food over the last couple of years, the last 15 years specifically, it's gone that whole sort of molecular way. You know, so all of these fancy bits and
things. It becomes like chemical laboratory stuff, right?
Exactly, and things exploding on plates and dropping out of ceilings and everything else. And and I think, you know, if you look at product,
setting your customers on fire.
Yeah, accidentally. Yeah. But but if you look at what's happened with it's gone almost back to product. Product is very important in sourcing product, and the whole cooking process is almost also just reverted back to the real thing, you know. So cooking on fire. I've recently travelled to New York and to Sydney, specifically to have a look at what's sort of going on.
Uh-huh.
And the trend there, I promise you, every second restaurant is cooking on fire. And it's crazy that we don't do it here at a sophisticated level, you know. So I think that's what we're trying to do.
I mean, and South Africans love cooking on a fire. It's probably the one thing out of everything that makes South Africans stick together. We can all agree on one thing, and that is that we like to cook on fire.
Yes.
And I love the fact that you said that, because I think the question that I get asked the question I get asked the most by international travelers and everything else is, what is South African cuisine? And it's a tricky one, and I hate saying bobotie and malva puddings, you know what I mean? It's because it's not really what we are.
Who knows?
Exactly. But the one thing that we do, you know, across the color lines is we love meat. We love cooking on fire. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Sounds
there.
Great. All right. Yeah. So this is a new thing for you then, to start this restaurant of your own, on your own, basically.
Yeah. Look, I've had restaurants before down in the Cape.
Rest and Frieda and everything. But
that wasn't mine.
And that wasn't yours?
No. That belonged to John Engelbrecht. But before that, I had my catering companies and restaurants and so forth. But you know, those were all sort of small, quirky sort of things that you sort of do by yourself. And you know, they're not. When you start talking about a 200-300 seater restaurant,
sure.
You know, it's a different kettle of fish completely.
It's a lot of food to prepare for people.
And cooking on fire. So it's not switch on, switch off. You know, it's not, you know, you've got to sort of negotiate the wood.
Tell me, how much of this is business and how much of it is actually being in the kitchen? Because I would imagine a name like yours is sufficient to launch a place and to get the menu sorted out and all the rest. But I don't think you'd actually spend a lot of time cooking food, right?
I think the reason why I've been lucky to be where I am is because I do spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
Really?
Yeah, and I think it's key.
Beneath you? I mean, I'm not trying to be funny about this.
No, not at all.
The experience you had, aren't you tired of the kitchen?
No.
Really?
No. I've tried other things and I haven't been that successful. I tried manager wine estate once.
Wow.
That lasted about 9 months. And I was asked to leave. So, yeah, you know, so I find myself back in the kitchen. That's how it goes.
And most of us... they're two camps. Most people either fall into the one camp where they absolutely love preparing food, and it feels like it's almost a devotion.
Yeah.
And then there are those people who just hate being in the kitchen. They think of it as routine and dull and dreary, and even when they're being creative, it's really just to produce food for hungry humans, and it's sort of unsatisfying in some way. Now, are there people in between who you can appeal to as well? Because as far as I can tell, everybody likes the taste of good food. It's just that not everybody likes to know how it's prepared. They just are either into it or they're not.
Yeah. Yeah, and the same goes for chefs, you know. You can just see, and I think that's how you gauge the sort of level of success of people, you know. There's a lot of chefs out there that actually don't enjoy being in the kitchen, and you can pick it up straight away. You can pick it up in the food, you know, when you eat the food. And especially with myself, I'm quite critical when I go out, and especially when I'm paying money for it.
Yeah.
So that pisses me off sometimes, you know. I mean, you want to feel sort of what's happening in a restaurant. You want to feel the vibe.
Uh-huh.
And
how do you create that? Because it's not just about the food.
No, it's not about and it's become very experiential. You know, if you look at restaurants now, it's got to be more than just food. There's no way. And I think that's what Marble, that's really what we're aiming with Marble. Fire is an incredible thing. You know, it's got a mind of its own, and it's very, it touches all the senses. You know, you can smell, you can see the crackle. And I think when you come there, you'll sort of get a real feel for what fire does for a restaurant. But just to get back to the experiential, you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes that restaurants make, you know, talking like an expert here. You know,
you're way more expert than me.
No. But I think when you walk into a restaurant, sometimes there's a huge disconnect between front of house and back of house. You know, you look at the menu, you walk in, it's quite glamorous, quite lekker, and then you look at the menu and you say, okay, well, this seems a bit odd. And then when the food comes, there's just complete disconnect. And I think that's really what we're trying to create here is we have a complete open plan kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
The chefs can really feel part of the room of what's going on. Those days of chefs being behind closed doors and for various reasons behind closed doors and can't get a feel for the restaurants are really over. You know, we really need to.
Also, I think people are suspicious of like a restaurant that keeps everything hidden away now. It used to be that that was where the food was prepared and it had nothing to do with you. But now I think people like to see that. And they also like to know that everything's being done, you know, sort of in a kosher way.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
That there isn't, someone isn't dropping steaks on the floor and then throwing them at you.
Yeah. And that does, I mean, I'll never ever forget my first job. I worked as a breakfast chef at the Tilburg Hotel. It was a three-star hotel down on the foreshore in Cape Town. And on Sundays there was a carvery. Because I was the youngest in the kitchen and didn't really know what I'm doing, they put me out on the carvery in front of everybody because nobody really wanted to come out of the kitchen. My head chef used to smoke dope under the extractor fan. I mean, literally. So he used to like send me out there. His name was Victor Lyons, an interesting character. Anyway, so And I mean, the stories, I can just tell you, Gareth, you're sort of running out of chickens, and there's whole frozen chickens going into chip fryers. And there's, I mean, the.
Oh, wow.
But you think as a youngster, as an 18, 19 year old, you think you've arrived. I mean, it's absolute chaos, you know, yeah. But it's absolute, it's cowboy antics, you know, it's
right.
Crazy.
But it's exciting.
But yes, yeah. It grabs you. And I thought I'd arrived, you know, I thought, this is my life. I mean, as you say, you know, chickens, whole chickens on floors, as you're carving, you know, you lose the whole sirloin accidentally, you know. That's ridiculous. But yeah, the open kitchen gives a little bit of theatre. People sort of feel part of what's going on, and it integrates the whole sort of front of house and back of house, and gives the customer, on client or guest, an added experience.
I mean, Mubs, Ben, do you like seeing what goes on in the kitchen?
It depends where you're eating. If it's somewhere fancy, definitely. Because you know it's cool things with really, like, you know, qualify people.
Yeah.
Somewhere not so fancy, just bring it.
Yeah.
Somewhere not so fancy, hide it. Don't even show me that stuff. Do you like to see it, Mabs?
I'm indifferent. Doesn't matter.
But I think if there's a show, then it's pretty cool. I mean, if there's a bit of action going on, or not really.
Well, I've never experienced that, so maybe I should.
Okay.
Yeah.
My buddy's usually tongue deep in the man opposite her, but
tongue deep in a bottle in. But yeah, if you go to this cool place and you see the fire, it's like really exciting, right? You go somewhere cheap and you see a fire, you think, oh shit.
The place is on fire. Yeah.
Good point.
Get out of here. The place is on fire. Yes, Flex.
I like those restaurants with like that open kitchen or has like a glass that you can see directly into the kitchen. I feel it's my right. To see how my food is prepared.
My right.
Okay.
Yep. You're going to collect Pokemons while you're in the restaurant?
I'm sure there's the Pikachus probably sitting at the Saxon.
All right, let me ask you something. When you prepare food for a cycling team, that has got to be the most... First of all, it's strict as all hell. I mean, you know you've got to keep calories down, and these people are probably really precious about what they eat in their stupid bicycles. And you have to cook up stuff that isn't always exciting, but it has to be nutritious and lean and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, these are single-minded people very often. Isn't that one of the worst jobs that a chef could hope for?
Well, I'm a cyclist. I know. Let's not get into this. But
oh,
I knew,
no. Get out of here.
I knew that was coming. Anyway, so moving on swiftly.
Okay, so you have some understanding of what they...
Exactly. About 3 years ago, I got into a really sort of active sort of training regime, and I lost about 20 kilos in 8 months training for a specific race.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a real understanding of what it takes and what is necessary. Anyway, I was invited along by Dougie Ryder to come and cook for the boys on the first Tour de France. And the first thing I just want to say is that the boys really, you know, no egos. You know,
oh, really?
No.
Okay,
egos.
Good. Okay, that's nice.
Because
then it makes your job easier.
100%. I mean, probably that was probably one of my biggest challenges. I think was just settling it down with the guys and making sure that everybody was covered from a dietary point of view. And the guys just said, you know, just do your thing. I think what you got to understand is the one thing that these guys have to look forward to. I mean, you look at yesterday. I don't know if you saw yesterday's stage, but the guys finished in hail. Literally, they started in 30 degree plus temperatures after 180 kilometers. They finished in hail. And it's unpleasant. So the only thing that these guys have got to look forward to is their massage and their food.
Yeah,
and that made it easy
because they're not taking in the scenery like we are, right?
No, we don't want to know where the next church is. And
they are supremely focused.
Yeah, so it actually made my job pretty easy. I cooked home cooked food, but I did it in a healthy sort of way. You know, instead of using sugars, we used agave syrups and honeys and that kind of thing, and not too much of it. And so we varied things along. It really was pretty simple. My major role there was really just was exactly that. It was almost a motivational role, but it was, as I said, it was one thing that they had to look forward to. And
yeah.
I would chat to the guys, and I'm from South Africa. A lot of the South African boys was their first Tour de France. They were away from home for 9 months. I could speak Afrikaans to a couple of them. So it was also you underestimate your sort of role, you know. And if it's been a long day and it's really hot, some of these days are 45 degrees. The guys were coming back. We prepare lovely smoothies for them, you know, with whatever product we could find on the day. So, no, I, you know, the whole experience for me was, was quite incredible, and it was key. You know, I mean, feeding the guys is key, as you can imagine, is key. The biggest challenge was every day you moved to a new kitchen, and you had to deal with some French prat who was either pissed at 10 o'clock in the morning, who didn't want to speak to you, didn't want to speak to you in English for a start.
French. Was,
yes, let me just.
And the
you.
French think they know everything about food, right?
And especially cycling. Everything. I mean, you can imagine the combination.
Yeah.
I mean, I was lost before I started. You know, I was done.
They didn't like one thing about you.
No. So it was. There was
so was a lot of times did you have sort of preset meals that you kind of planned or thought you would do, only to then find you couldn't get ingredients? Was it like difficult like that?
Well, I tried that. I've tried that for the first 3 days. So the first, I had my whole sort of trip planned, and you know, all these great ideas, and anyway, so eventually it became a sort of run into the closest decent supermarket and health store, see what's on the shelf, and that was it. Literally every day was like that. You literally, and you're running, you know.
Sounds like Survivor, not like the Tour de France.
Amazing Race, Chef Edition.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that was it. You know, just find what's fresh, what's, you know, you got to be so careful of you know, like hormones in meats and stuff. So you had to try and get as much organic stuff as possible.
Wow, yeah, of course.
Because you can't feed this guy. Because a couple of years back, I mean, Ben, you know.
Sure, there were
some of the guys were saying, yeah, they ate some meat with some, you know, hormones in, you know.
So they were busting everybody for whatever was going on, even if they didn't know they had stuff in their food.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway. But it was, let me just tell you, what an incredible experience to, I mean, what the guys go through. And you know, you think it's quite glamorous and the TVs and everything else. Those guys come back and they sleep in one-star hotels, you know, because the tour is too big. It's 2,500 vehicles.
Yeah, you can't accommodate everybody.
You'd gridlock a city. So basically, everybody slept in airports and industrial areas, because the only place where the buses and stuff could park. No air conditioning in the rooms. The beds were, I mean, literally, I mean, it's ridiculous. The beds were probably 30, 40 years old, you know. And,
but then it's like that. Most teams, or was Team Sky, they.
No.
They're still in their
touch. So Team
places.
Sky, yes, last year, bought 11, what do you call those, camper vans.
Yeah.
Like down to the, and they weren't allowed to use them. So what they said is that it works on a rotational sort of basis. So if you get a bad hotel, the one day you try and get to a better hotel, but the better hotel is like from a one-star to a two-star. So they do
with grumpy French people who run them.
Moth-eaten sheet.
Yeah.
And they probably only see people at Tour de France time, because there's some parts of the tour that... There's no reason to be in France at that particular place at that time.
Yeah, and especially not an industrial area.
Yeah. Jeez, that sounds horrible.
Wow, I was under the impression these guys were just... So they had these amazing trailer RV things, and then what?
So management slept in them.
Jeez, that doesn't sound right. Huh?
No wonder they all look so like weather-beaten and really mean in that race.
And unhappy. Yeah. Well... to me, it's also exciting. I mean, you represented South Africa at the Culinary World Cup in Switzerland and the Culinary Olympics in Germany. But the pressure must be enormous there, because it's down to someone's opinion, effectively, or a panel of people's opinion. Just you feel like you're on that stupid MasterChef, you know?
Well, let's go further. You know, you think you're on some other foodie blog, or, you know.
Yeah.
Let me not get into that, because I think that's one of my biggest hates.
Isn't it horrible? Because people on a food blog can these days, they have such power they shouldn't have.
No, Gareth, I tell you, if there's something that irks me, it's
they've
that,
become the new critics, right?
100%.
And at least the critics...
Journalists, you know.
At least the critics had to have some kind of track record and credibility.
Yep.
A blogger could be anybody, any loser from anywhere, and if they have a shitty meal once,
yep,
they'll write the most horrible things about you. There's just nothing you can do.
But the shitty meal is their opinion. At least when it comes to a food critic, the guy's giving you technical sort of, you know,
yeah,
I've burnt the food, I've oversalted, I've overdone this.
Sure, he has some idea
but
of what he's
talking
about.
Because you don't like pumpkin with pecan nuts, you know what I mean? You know, I don't know why the chef has done this combination, or done, you know, that's your opinion, mate. I don't really care for your opinion.
Have you heard of Yelp?
Yeah.
In America, it's a big deal.
Such a great South Park episode about that yeah, everyone in the town becomes Yelpers.
Yeah.
So much so that the restaurants then revolt and there's this massive war.
Yeah.
But how much has it changed? I mean, first of all, let me ask you about ingredients, because that's something that's become very different. And there never were this many ingredients in restaurants 50 years ago.
Yep.
There's no way. Like, now you can get anything all year round if you're prepared to pay for it.
Yeah.
People are putting strange combinations of food together that sometimes work, sometimes don't. But you can effectively get anything, which not only makes it difficult for you to buy the stock that you need and actually use it before it goes off.
Yeah.
But it also means that people have very high expectations.
Yeah.
How does that complicate just doing really good meals?
Well, this is where you've got to be very, very careful. And it was one of the things, funny that you say that, because it was one of the things when I came from Rissenfrieder, where I could be quite adventurous with the food. And then I got to the Saxon with 500, we started then. And
The restaurant was called 500. Yeah,
I had to be very careful with the combinations. You know, people just didn't want sort of white anchovy with dark chocolate. You know what I mean? So
in other words, are you saying that? No, but I mean, is there a difference between the Cape Town palate or the Winelands palate and the palate of a Joburg?
Yeah, I think the Cape Town palate is quite open. Again, there's a lot of chefs doing a lot of things. So everybody was sort of used to these sort of interesting combinations that were going around. And yeah,
so they were a little more experimental.
A little bit more experimental. And when I got to Joburg, you know, because not a lot of people were doing it, there was a lot of sort of
resistance
to it, for sure.
So are you saying Joburg people, not as interesting from a culinary point of view?
No, let's not get into that conversation.
No, come on.
No, I just think that because the Cape Town folk were exposed to it more, they were a little bit more open to it. It's definitely changing in Joburg. There's a restaurant down at the sheds called Urbanology. They're doing a lot of stuff. DW11 is doing quite a lot of stuff. All of a sudden, there's a lot of interesting things sort of going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it is definitely changing, and that's great to see. But also, you know, not everybody wants the weird and wonderful combinations. Some people just want really well-cooked food, and I think there's a market for that too, because there's a whole lot of crap around as well, you know.
And do you agree less is more? I mean, sometimes you only need a couple of ingredients to make some good stuff.
Well, that's exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing, you know. And just to talk about ingredients, you know, I started cooking in 1989, and it was all about iceberg lettuce, curly leaf parsley, and tomato roses. I don't even remember if you used to peel a tomato and make a rose with curly parsley on the side and iceberg lettuce. And that was really what was available. Now we can probably get 56 different varietals of lettuce, you know. I mean, I don't know what we do with them. They don't taste like anything, but, you know, they're there. They're available. So, yeah, it has the change has been interesting.
But, Dave, what kind of stuff are you cooking at home for yourself, though? Because, I mean, your life is about all of this, and you could tell us about 50 bloody shades of lettuce.
Like last night. Did you go out last night, or were you at home?
I was at a mate's engagement party last night, so they had a quite a big Jewish spread there. I'm a huge fan of gnocchi. I would like for gnocchi and pesto would be my like ultimate meal. I sit home and eat. But I'm very much about mood as well. When it comes to food and drink, it just depends on my mood. I love a braai, obviously. I mean, that's shellfish on a braai is like one of those things that you almost can't get better. You know, it's a bit snobbish, but it is. It's one of those special things. But well-matured meat on a fire is great. But again, and breakfast. I could eat breakfast all day.
Really?
Yeah. That is the best.
Literally, bacon and egg. I could eat it when I get home at night. You know. So,
I don't think you'll have any fight from anyone there.
Yeah, exactly.
David, I want to know, in March of 2013, Justin Bieber stayed at the Saxon. Did you cook for him?
Yeah, I happened
you
to.
You did?
Yeah. Mm.
You've just made flex.
What was his favorite meal?
You know what? It was so insignificant, I can't even remember. He ate very simply.
He just ruined his day.
He made ours, though.
No, he did. It wasn't particularly healthy. It was sort of takeaway. We had to get some takeaways and pizzas.
What takeaways? I need specifics.
He enjoyed Nando's. I think everybody enjoys Nando's.
Everyone
actually.
Loves Nando's.
Yeah, exactly. So that was, I think that was one of the hits. But yeah, it wasn't really.
Did you meet him, though?
No.
No.
No. Maybe.
Did you want to? You didn't care.
Not really. No.
Have you ever like delivered food to someone's room and you open up the door and you're like, oh, Prince Charles?
The nanny. Fran Drescher.
Did she say, oh cool.
My God, that's such great food.
I had to go and chat to her about her meal, but she was pretty cool. Yeah.
So she was talkative. See, a lot of people don't know how to deal with the chef, because the chef's really important. He's like management at the hotel.
Yeah.
He's not the waiter. He's not the guy who's doing a lot of the rudimentary stuff in the kitchen. So a lot of people aren't sure whether it's appropriate to say, you know, compliments to the chef, or whether it's appropriate to have, when the chef comes over, to have a conversation with him or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
There's a whole etiquette involved.
No, absolutely. And it is very important to us. We really do, enjoy the interaction. And especially when guests arrive at hotels, it's really important to talk to them. We know who's fussy and who's not fussy. And you need to sort all those things out before the shit starts, really.
What's the worst, What's the worst kind of customer you have at either a restaurant or a hotel or anything like that? Who are the and you don't have to mention names, but explain the kind of people, because there's a certain type of person who's just, you can tell when they come in they're a problem, right?
Yeah, I mean it's
describe
really
that
if you know the industry and the restaurant industry, you'll pick it up when people walk through the door.
What
and,
do you look
and the
for?
Issue the issue there is let me just start at the front. You know, it could be the security guard that upset him before he walked through the door. He couldn't find parking. You know, it's all these sort of things. You've had a bad day. You know, you've got stuck in traffic. So the guy walks through the door and immediately is edgy. He's, you know, he doesn't like the table he's sat at. You know, well, you know, all the other tables, literally the restaurant's full. There's one table left. It's the table that he's booked, unfortunately. And now he's throwing a scene because he wants to sit somewhere else. But what do you want me to do?
And
honestly.
You just know.
He just carries on and on and on. And the next thing, it's the Persian carpet that doesn't go with the interiors. You know what I mean?
You've had people
I've had that. I've had, you know, and that's again, that's that whole opinion thing. You know, this Persian carpet really doesn't go with this room.
Then, but have you ever told anyone, look, well, just leave then?
I've only asked someone to leave once.
How did that happen? Tell me that story.
Well, basically, it was one of these situations where nothing was good enough, you know, and eventually you just say, look, you know, nothing that I do tonight. And he was actually, you know what? He was a hotelier. He was a manager at a hotel in Cape Town. Can you believe that? And this is a Bristol Theatre. It's not a half-assed restaurant.
You'd think this guy would have some kind of sympathy for you. Not at all, huh?
Nothing. And he had a go. And then, you know, the biggest cowards are those that start having a go at your staff. They don't want to talk to the management or whatever. They want to have a go at the staff. And when you walk up to the table, then everything's okay.
Imagine working for this guy. It must be hell. So did you come up to the table and say to him, look, dude, thanks very much for coming. Yeah, I need you to go.
Enough is enough. You know, and, we're obviously not going to please you tonight. And it's not going to work. So, you know.
Fuck off.
That's it. Yeah, basically. Yeah. In a nice way.
Wow. Okay. That's not. It's not all the fun and games.
No. Look, I mean, and I think that's my biggest fear. I've generally been involved with small restaurants, yeah, 20, 30 seaters, 40 seaters mainly. So when it comes to 200 seaters, I think my biggest fear is firstly the social media. You know, as good as it is, it can kill you in a day, and I'm very aware of that. And
does it make you paranoid?
Yeah, it does make me paranoid. And you know what I've ended up doing is actually not reading things like TripAdvisor, not going to all the eat-out sites and so forth. I actually avoid them because it upset me.
The only time I look at them is to find out the address of the place.
Yeah, exactly.
I could care less for other people's reviews of food.
Yeah.
So, how are they going to know what works for you and how you? Everything's so subjective.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of my biggest fears. And then the other thing is just, you know, it's on a daily. I can see, you know, on a daily basis, just dealing with difficult situations. But so yeah, that's part of the game.
Who do you rate in terms of famous chefs all over the world? Who do you reckon are the best, and who do you think have all these reputational quirks, but they aren't necessarily that good? Just give me a couple of people you do admire. And
let me just tell you something about Gordon Ramsay, for instance. You know, Gordon Ramsay is a renter and a raver, and you know, and he's sort of put himself across that way.
He's a showman.
He's quite a showman, but he's a bloody good chef. Let me just tell you, you know, and I don't particularly like him. I've met him a few times, and you know, he's not a particularly nice guy, but he is incredibly good at what he does. And he's a three-star Michelin chef. You don't just get three-star Michelins or three Michelin stars. It's you know, you got to be pretty talented to be able to do that. So you know. For what he's done, you look at the Jamie Olivers of the world. You know, as much as we hate him as an individual, you know, and but he's done incredible things for chefs. He's brought the chefs out of the kitchens. He's given us a bit of a persona. We you know, people now demand to see the chefs. You know, in a good way. You know, they really want to interact with us. And I guess these guys have done a hell of a lot for us. Again, as I said in the beginning, we were behind closed doors and there was a shouting and screaming going on, pots and pans being thrown around, and now it's all these open kitchens where you've got to be really careful and sort of, you know, become a bit of a personality as well, you know, engaging with guests. And
don't you think that the customer has too much say these days? The customer wants to have banting food, they want to have paleo food, they want to be vegan, they want to be vegetarian, they want to be pescatarian. They have too much say.
Yeah.
You should say, this is the kind of food we do at our restaurant. If you don't like it, piss off. Go somewhere else. There's got to be something else for you somewhere.
Well, that's because some idiot told them that the customer is always right, and then it all went to our heads.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I think the dietary requirements are one of your worst nightmares, and especially with big tables. You know, you get a table of 10, and there's six dietary requirements. You know, we don't eat this, we don't eat that, we don't eat starch. And I guess that, you know, you sort of learn to deal with it. But I think when you start covering everything on your menu, when you're sort of designing your menu and you sort of make sure that there's something for everybody, it becomes relatively
easy. But you do get, like, you'll get a table sometimes and everybody at that table has some particular thing. They're allergic to this. They can't eat that. This must be halal. That must be kosher. This can't contain fish. This can't contain bread. These people make it so hard for everyone to just have a fun night out because of their crappy dietary requirements.
Yes. You must try and be in the kitchen. You must actually join me in the kitchen one day. And, and when those orders come in, you must see how frustrating it is. You've got a full restaurant. You literally have a full restaurant.
Yeah.
And you get this page of dietary requirements, you know, with no warning. You know, when people place, when they make reservations, you know, we always ask, you know, are there any dietaries and anything else? And no. It's too casual. And when they come in, then all of this hits you. And to try and fix that in a full restaurant, it's a flippin' nightmare. And it affects everybody around you. It's exactly what you said. It affects everybody around you.
No, if you've got 100 dietary requirements, stay at home.
Yeah.
You've got to make your own food.
Yeah.
Really, you can't complicate everyone else's life. Mubs, what is our rule?
Don't make your problems everybody else's problem.
So that's our rule.
But what do you think is like the most, you get like fads and trends and all that kind of crap. What's been the most sort of annoying and in your mind, the most just non-rational kind of thing? You can say banting.
Say whatever you like. You don't have to protect anybody here.
No, I think, you know, I guess, I don't want to say this, but gluten-free has always been a...
I was about to say, that's my pet peeve.
Some bullshit, right?
Yeah, I I know I have a very dear friend who I know it plays havoc on her intestines. You know? I mean, there are people. But every second person is gluten-free, you know? I mean, it's absolute bollocks, you know? And it really does affect what you put on a plate, you know? It really does, it changes the meal. You know, so gluten-free is something that I just feel is just over,
Yeah, we had this chat on Friday in the open office here. It's like talking about, you know, when's the last time someone said, you know, my health is so bad, I think I'm really just, the gluten's killing me, or I died last week because of gluten.
Died. Well, if they died, they wouldn't be.
Yeah.
But it is one of those things that people, okay, you get the odd case, just like you get people who have thyroid issues, that's why they're overweight. It's very slim.
Yeah.
But sorry, it's very few in numbers. But, you know, people, it's like such a fashionable thing to say nowadays, well, I'll only have it if it's gluten-free.
No.
But what's the gluten going to do to you?
And the other thing is just don't eat it. If the plate comes, just push it aside, you know what I mean?
But half of these people won't even be able to tell you what gluten is.
Well, there you go, there's nothing. Because sometimes it does, you know, you have a slip and they eat, you see the plate comes back and it's all being eaten.
I think it's everybody wants to be special. You know, they just want a little bit of attention. They want everyone at the table to go, ooh, you don't eat gluten. How
what
exciting
informed,
for you.
Sarah, informed choice.
Sarah, we thought you were so boring before, but now that you mentioned the gluten, we're just blown away by how exciting you are to be around.
Wow,
tell us more about your eating problems.
You look exactly the same, but your choices, wow.
Sarah, you just blown me away. What is this kale? What is that? What is kale?
Kale is a leafy vegetable. The Portuguese. Hey, Portuguese.
Oh yeah, well done to the Portuguese. Don't worry.
Do we get it in South Africa?
Don't you worry. That's coming up next. They'll have that on the Vola Football Show for Euro. And I see that they've got lots to talk about. They got people here in Portuguese kit. Everything. It's going to be very exciting. So don't miss the football show coming up next. Voila, Euro 2016. That's with Stefano and Vivian. That's next. But back to kale. So what is kale?
So kale is a leafy vegetable, not unlike cabbage, but quite bitter. And
it tastes like bug spray.
Yeah, basically. Mm. And but when you start mixing it with things like chorizos and
have you ever tasted your deodorant, Mubs?
No, why would I?
Well, maybe you sprayed the deodorant on and somewhere in your mouth. That's how it tastes. That's how kale tastes, and people think it's fucking
fantastic.
Now explain
the bug spray. How did you end up tasting bug spray?
No, I didn't.
You grew up on a farm.
I assume DDT in its pure form tastes just like kale.
Yeah, when you add other things to it, it really comes to life.
This is a fashion fad, right? This is not something that should be part of anyone's dietary requirements.
Yeah, it's like cabbage juice, you know. I mean, why would you drink cabbage? Yeah, why would you do that? You know, so
what's the worst thing you've ever made that people wanted it, even though you knew it was bullshit?
Yeah, cabbage juice.
Cabbage juice.
Yeah. Have you smelled this? I mean,
that's
quite interesting. Yeah, when you work at hotels, especially, you know. you get lists when the sort of the VIPs check in. Yeah. They have their requirements.
Their riders.
Yeah. And in those riders, there's always a vegetable, a juice, a fresh juice, you know. And I mean, whether, you know, it's obviously all the norm, but cabbage juice was definitely one of the list. Can you imagine the after effects of that?
Disgusting. You know, you must just open up on both sides.
Gassy.
Yeah, and gas. How horrible. What's the most expensive ingredient you have to add regularly to meals?
On a regular basis.
Or even exceptionally. Most crazy price for one kind of ingredient.
Look, I think truffles are probably the we're not.
What do truffles cost?
So truffles, I think the last time I checked...
They still dig those out with a pig in the forest,
yeah, the
right?
Pigs or the dogs, yeah. So so the truffles, the last price I saw was, I think, 26,000 rand a kilo for the black truffle, and then it's about 150,000 rand a kilo for the white truffle.
150,000 rand a kilo?
A kilo, yeah.
So why?
If I come to a restaurant and you've prepared truffles for me, I'd assume in some kind of dessert or something.
No. It generally goes with things like risottos and
okay.
And
so I'm ordering a risotto and it's got some truffle in it. What does that do to the price?
So a normal risotto costs about 3.50 to make, you know, and a good portion. I mean, we're talking about rice, and, you know, so 3.50. So all of a sudden, the dish becomes 3,500 rand because you've put 2 grams of truffle onto it. I mean, it literally is that ridiculous.
And does it make that much of a difference to the taste?
You know what? I'm gonna go with yeah, it does. It's
really.
It's quite an ingredient. I mean, there's
what
nothing.
What does it taste like? I've never had truffles in anything.
Yeah. It tastes like old shoes, really, but a special old shoe. You know, it's like
okay.
Like the soul of a really
3,500 rand for an old shoe taste. This is great.
No, I'm teasing. No. The one thing with truffle is that you can't replicate the flavor. You know, it is what it is. It's very specific and I can't
believe that price. 150,000 rand for a kilogram.
Well, that's why you just don't get white truffle yet. You know, it's just too expensive. The black truffle you still get and so forth. So, yeah. So it's
wow.
pretty.
And how do you even put that in? Do you shave off tiny little bits?
So basically, you get a special truffle shaver. Obviously, at that price, it comes with a shaver. And you just thin slivers. And I think it comes out about 0.5 gram at a time. You know, that's what it's supposed to do. But yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. Is there anything else that comes close?
No. Yeah, caviar, I suppose. You know, when you're starting adding proper caviar to dishes, that's about, I think those tubs are about, for proper beluga, it's probably about 50,000 rand for. What is it, about a 300 grand tub? I mean, you know, it's
expensive.
It's a proper amount of money.
And are there seasonings and certain kinds of things that you, herbs and spices and additives and things that you can add in that would be very expensive too?
Not really. I think when it comes to you know, things like oils are expensive. You know, there's in North Africa they have the argan, you know, argan oils and things like that, and they're very specific flavor. You can't really explain. So you have to get quite specific and quite sort of almost territorial to get the really expensive products. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the strangest delicacies you've experienced, like bull's testicles or whatever?
Yeah, testicles is not bad.
Practice.
They're standard practice. Yeah, bulls. Balls, great. They taste very much like liver, same sort of textures and so forth. Crispy scorpion, overrated.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it's like the Mapani worms, you know. It's
dust.
Yeah, exactly.
Mapani worms taste like dust.
Yeah.
I explained this to someone once because we had to eat them as like a dare once. And I had one, and it was just like eating a handful of dust.
Yeah. Sand. But then I think things like, things that are not so exotic, but things like fish heads, incredible flavor. You know, a fish head in the cheeks and the eyes, you know, just great flavor.
Rashida, would you eat that stuff?
My panu worms.
Yeah.
I used to eat them all the time at my grandma's place.
You liked them?
That was a delicacy.
You liked them?
Love them.
Were they all dry as well?
Well, some of them are dry. Some of them are a bit wet. It depends on when you pick them.
Oh my God.
She's always so happy.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she doesn't even mind
us. She's never had a bad day in her entire life.
Cindy on WeChat says, what about saffron?
Yeah, saffron, of course. So saffron is the stamen of a crocus. So it's a flower. And and they get handpicked. Literally, guys climb cliffs and pick these flowers and these little stamens then get in. You know what saffron is? It gives that beautiful color. Paella is probably the most common form. It gives that beautiful deep yellow color. But the flavor is very specific. You don't get anything like, and that's what I'm saying about these very specific from areas. And they give very specific flavors. So yeah.
Wow.
Have you ever dealt with customers who try to show off and try to prove that they could possibly know as much as you, even though they're not a chef?
Isn't that the worst?
You know what,
those pretentious assholes.
When it comes to wine, so I mean, not only, I mean, wine pairings for me has become one of the most overrated things. You know, people trying to force, you know, this Syrah has to go with this sort of smoked oxtail. You know what I mean? We all have our palates, and everybody's different. Everybody's makeup is different. We like different things. So don't tell me that
it's like art. There's no right or wrong. Yeah,
for sure. I'm really quite desperate to move away from all of that, which is exactly the reason why I'm sort of moving in the direction that I am.
David,
but yo,
why?
Oh, Flex.
Oh, did I disturb you? Sorry.
He was just busy answering something.
It's okay.
Michael, he didn't care about Bieber. Just forget about that. He just didn't care about him.
If this is a Bieber question, then I'm going to chase you out.
I really want to know, why is caviar so expensive when don't fish have like thousands and thousands of eggs in them?
But it's a specific kind of fish that you only find in a specific kind of place.
Yeah, it's a sturgeon. And although they carry kilos of eggs, it's from either the Baltic Sea or very specific regions. Again, very sort of region,
hard
territorial.
To farm.
Hard to find and hard to find. I guess that's what throws the price, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, talk about difficult customers.
Yeah.
People's opinions
about
wine
pairings, isn't it?
But then, and that's why you've got to brief your staff so well, you know, because your wine steward or your sommelier or whatever goes up to the table and suggests a wine, and some oak starts mouthing off about, and he's talking about an Italian wine. And he's talking about a French region, from a French region. So you know that he's talking absolute nonsense. You know, but there's no way that
can say to him,
but those are the best.
Don't you enjoy putting them in their place and saying to them, oh, you're a douche, because that's not from France?
It's so difficult when it's your own place. You know, when you're sitting at a table with other people, when you've been invited, that's my best. You know, because then nobody knows you're a chef.
Yeah.
So some eggs mouthing off's my best. So you're at a table of 10, we're going out, you know, people that I don't really know that well, or, you know, I'm not great at that anyway. But anyway, so hypothetically, I go out and some oak starts mouthing off about, you know, the free range cattle from the Free State or whatever, you know, and then you sort of pipe up from the side, you know, and that must feel good.
But then at the same time, it must be very, very intimidating for anyone else when you walk into their restaurant. If they do recognize you, then they go, oh my God, there's that David Higgs. He's gonna find something wrong with us.
I'm not overcritical when I eat at restaurants. I'd kill myself if I do. You know, so I just I think the difficult thing is that you don't get invited to too many people's houses, to be honest.
Oh really?
Yeah.
That's a good point, because if I had to have you around to my house, I'd be shitting myself about what to make.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a bummer. So usually people come to my to my place. Although my good mate Dan Nichols has been pretty good.
You know Dan as well.
Yeah. Mm. So what does
he eat?
So he eats everything.
A lot.
Yeah. Daniel's son. Anyway, so he's about the only guy that's not intimidated. He feeds me lots of wine and I end up cooking anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah, all right. Do you think South Africans have a sophisticated palate? I mean, you mentioned Cape Town earlier, and Colour says Rustenburg is like 90% tourists, so it says nothing about the Cape Town palate. Cape Townians, according to him, eat fish and chips or spur. Do you think the South African palate's refined? I mean, the French have this reputation across the world for being extraordinary judges of whether something has culinary quality or not. Yeah. But is that always true?
I think what South Africans like, you know, when it comes to food and brying and so forth, we love the barbecue spices, we like the chili spices, we like the things that are sweet, we like the things that burn, you know, that's generally the South African palate. And again, it doesn't matter who or what you are, you know, that's really what the South African palate is.
So you're
is.
Saying we're rubes, I mean, really?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I'm one of them, you know. But slowly but surely, the guys are asking for less of the basting sauces. You know, like my pet hate in restaurant, when you've got a really good piece of meat and Oak says, no, please, just
baste it. Covered it in chutney.
The basting sauce.
Yeah. You got any mushroom sauce? Can I put the creamy one?
Could possibly put that on the side for you. No. Anyway, so I think our palate has definitely changed over the last couple of years, definitely over the last 10 years, but we're still very fond of our sweet and spicy, you know, and that's why we like Asian food so much, you know, the Chinese and the Japanese foods. I mean, those generally, I mean, they are spicy, they're sweet. Mm-hmm. Curries, I love a good curry. I think our palates are probably a little bit less refined, but we know what we like, you know. At least we know that.
Yeah.
At least when Oak comes and sits down in the restaurant, right, so and he says, I like that. You
know. When is your new restaurant, Marble, open?
Gareth, that's a good question. We were supposed to be open on the 2nd of March.
is it going to be in the next month or two? I mean, must we keep an eye on the...
No, I'll certainly let you know. We'll be open, I'm hoping, the first week of August.
Oh, okay.
And that's sort of the goal at the moment. And awesome. We're really excited. So we want to give Joburg a lekker experience.
Apart from the fire and the food, what else makes it a little bit different?
It's got incredible views.
Where is it?
It's you know where Circa Art Gallery is?
Yes.
So right next to Circa Art Gallery, the same architects of Circa Art Gallery, Studio Massive, actually revamped the old Chevron building. There's that Caltex underneath with the BGR.
Right.
So on top of the roof, they've added another deck and another
sounds
lab.
Great.
So exciting time. So we've got an incredible bar as well that we'll be serving some tapas in a nice, quite a swanky little bar.
Sounds great.
So yeah, looking forward to it.
All right, man. Well, I'll be there. That's David Higgs. Go to Marble, his new restaurant, and what an interesting life of kind of. Have you ever hurt yourself cooking? Burnt yourself badly? Stabbed yourself with a knife?
Yeah, I stabbed myself a few times. That's lost a few nerves. Can't feel anything in this thumb. You know,
oh, really?
Kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm not a chef, but I once almost sliced my finger off with an avo.
There we go.
Now I just don't cut avos myself. I have someone else cut them for me because I'm useless. Such a child. Mubs, it was hanging by a thread.
Yes, I remember you and Kuli Chana compared fingers after he got shot in the hand.
Yes, that's right.
And my
wound was
worse than his.
Yeah, let's remind people.
Jersey is rough.
Damn right. Very, very dangerous here. All right, thank you to David Higgs. And if you missed anything on the podcast this morning, you will find all of it. You will find it all on cliffcentral.com, so you don't have to miss a thing. Here's what's coming up the rest of the day. We've got Voila Euro Show for the final time this morning, along with friends, icons, and legends in the football industry. Stefano Vigoriti and Vivian Casaletti will both be in here. The show will take you through all the action. They'll do a proper synopsis of Euro 2016 this year, and what an amazing tournament it's been. The Bounce Show with Ben Karpinski, rugby, football, golf. Ben has assembled some of the sharpest minds in these three sports to wrap up the weekend sports action for you in this week's edition of the show. Plus, he has a special look ahead to the playoffs in Super Rugby and the Open Championship. Did I leave anything out?
No, that was very good, Gareth.
Excellent. Yeah. Zoom conversations on this morning between 11 and 12 with KF Malindi and Kamu Piri. We met them on this show last week. Zimbabwe is obviously number one, front and center in the news at the moment. And as Zimbabwe's buildings burn down and the people rise up, the guys speak to Arnold Tsunga, who's the director of the International Commission of Jurists in Africa. And the state of the nation and human rights in Africa. Then it's the Leadership Platform with Adrian Groenewald that is brought to you by Sibanye Gold. The Leadership Master Lesson today. What does the future CEO look like? Adrian, Louis and Ellis, along with Alan Shedlow, who is the partner from Hendrick and Struggles, discuss the essential topic. They're joined by Dr. Brenda Hutting, who's an international speaker and author. Then it's a Leadership Lesson sponsored by Sibanye Gold. USB Ed brings you the business skills conversation. How do you manage fraud in your business? They'll talk about that. And then SMEs. The team interviews the founder and director of Polytech Forensic Investigations. Starting with a background in the police for 13 years, Trevor Henn now runs a successful business in polygraph testing and forensic investigations. Leadership and Transformation with Wayne Duvenage, who's the chairperson of OUTA. That's the organization undoing tax abuse. We'll talk about the panel and the transformation of South Africa's civic society at the forefront of the battle against e-tolls. I love Wayne, so you must listen to that between 2 and 2.30 today. 2.30 until 3 is the Youth Leadership Platform. Adrian, Louis and Chanel will speak to Lesego Seloane, who is the regional finalist for Miss Earth South Africa and an entrepreneur for landscaping and image consulting, also a philanthropist focusing on environmental awareness. And then 3 o'clock, it's Futurology with Brett Levy, Brett Lindsay. They will take on the mundane in technological terms and complicated, and they will make it exciting and interesting. And trust me, if there's any show that has any new gadget, if there's any show that's talking about what kinds of developments there are in technology over the next couple of years, it's these guys. Brett Levy, Brett Lindsay, Futurology between 3 and 4. 4 o'clock, Aria Kelman is back with Kelman and Cliff Central. This week's Gentleman's Round Table features rapper JR. They also check in on the latest celebrity news with The Juice. Vaughn Thiel has the spoken hustle. And Dr. Karen Elcock is there for fitness and health. That's a wrap on today. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. The Cape exit seems to be more than just an opportunistic joke. The Cape Party, a political party hell-bent on breaking the Cape province away from South Africa, say they need just 5,000 votes in the upcoming elections to set the wheels in motion. Free the Cape is their motto, but much like Boris Johnson and the Brexit, they don't actually know what that will entail. In other news, Zimbabwe is being urged to adopt the rand as their official currency. Zimbabweans are hesitant, though. They may not have an economy, but they also know how quickly Jacob Zuma can ruin the rand every time he opens his mouth. And finally, the Portuguese are over the moon after their team won the Euro 2016 final against France. They didn't win a single game in 90 minutes, but that matters not. They're title holders. What this also means is that in the Ronaldo versus Messi stakes, Ronaldo is not a criminal, and he's a major international trophy winner for his national team. Messi. We will see you tomorrow. Be good. CliffCentral.com.